This is Everyday We're Hustling. I'm Miranda Campbell. More and more, young people are trying to turn their creative projects into careers. Getting this going involves struggle, commitment, and a whole lot of work. Every day we're hustling. Our guests work in different creative fields, but what they have in common is this hustle. Pursuing a creative career means juggling artistic and economic demands. It's a constant balancing act, and the road to making a living isn't always clear. So, how are young people managing all this? On this episode, we'll discuss breaking out and starting your own creative business. How do you become a creative entrepreneur if you never went to business school? Our guests discuss how they found their niche and learned to manage a growing enterprise. Not having a traditional 9-to-5 is one of the biggest perks, but also one of the biggest challenges of running your own business. Our guests tell us how they're managing. After Nafisa Kaptanwala graduated with an art history degree from Concordia, she set her sights abroad. While working at the Ace Hotel in London, she found herself surrounded by people working in fashion. She also noticed a lack of people of color getting work in the industry. So in 2013, she founded Lord Modeling Inc., the first modeling agency to exclusively represent people of color. Lord Inc. now operates out of Toronto, New York, and London. Hi, Nafisa. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Nafisa, you have a modeling agency called Lord Inc. How did that come about?
So it started in 2014. I was living in London, the UK at the time. And it really just started because I just graduated from an art history program with a BFA, and I was trying to find a job in a creative field and was having the hardest time pretty much getting my foot through the door. And so on top of being frustrated with that and also kind of wanting to see like something different, there's like something in the air where I was like, we are missing people in this industry that look like me and that look like my friends. And so, yeah, I just started. I just was like, you know what? I want to start a modeling agency. I'm going to start shooting my friends. And I didn't anticipate, like at the time I wasn't thinking like, oh, this is going to be a business endeavor. At the time I was like, oh, this is just a fun creative project and we'll see where it goes. And it just got so much momentum so quickly that it turned into a business.
Yeah. So your modeling agency features non-white models. Mm-hmm. You felt like there was a lack of diversity in the fashion business?
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely there being a lack of diversity in fashion, but at the time I was kind of more focused on the people in my community. So mostly art photographers, as well as like editorial fashion photographers. And I was like, this is fucked. Like, where are all the people of color? Like, why aren't these people that are friends of mine even not shooting people that look like me and look like the other people in our community?
So you have a background in art history. You're noticing a gap and a problem in particular creative fields. Do you have a background in photography or business?
Nope.
So tell us about that. How did you get going with starting your own initiative and breaking out?
I just surrounded myself with a lot of business savvy people and photographers and stylists and like people that are working all different aspects of the industry and like asked a lot of questions and really wanted to get to know with what they were doing. So there is a point where I would like, and I still do this with every kind of aspect of the industry that I kind of want to get more familiar with. I started like coming up with projects for editorials and then inviting photographers to shoot with me, like friends of mine to shoot the photos for me, and then just watching what they were doing, asking them questions. And then the next time I worked on an editorial, I shot it myself. So we just started to learn things that way, just by watching what other people are doing and asking tons of questions. Googling, YouTube. I learned how to edit photos from YouTube, basically just like having the ambition to kind of teach myself how to do stuff.
How did that contrast with your formal education in art history? Watching, asking, Googling versus classroom?
Well, funny enough, before I got into school for art history, I did a 2-year diploma program in journalism. And the program that I was in was like very, very hands-on and very much about like, here's a quick 15-minute tutorial on how to do this. Now go and do it. So the idea of like teaching myself how to do things is very second nature.
You know, you were already familiar with that, but it was taking those skills to a new line of business.
Totally.
Sometimes when we think art history, we think learning about painting, the history of art.
Yeah.
What did you personally get out of your art history degree?
Well, for starters, when I went into art history, it wasn't because I cared so much about the history of art. I really didn't. I wanted to have a cultural studies degree, but I also did care about the creative industry, and art history was kind of like the only route that felt like made sense for me. But what I felt like it gave me and what I was looking for when I went into that was I wanted to have like a critical eye and be critical about representation and be critical about the media. It's kind of given me a lens on how fashion affects culture and what it's saying to people.
Your attention to issues of race and representation, did that get fostered through your time at university?
Yeah. So when I did my art history degree, I intentionally went into it looking to focus on race and representation.
And how do you approach people in the industry who don't have the same politics, who don't have a critical background? How do you work with those people?
I mean, it's hard. Ideally, I'd like to just call them out. But because we have to share a space, which is this industry, I have to approach them on like a business perspective and be like, hey, it'd be helpful for your business if you represented people this way or if you included more models of color.
There's a business argument for diversity as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Did you feel shy asking questions to people working in the business?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm not like a forthcoming person at all. Like, a lot of people have this, but you worry about just looking stupid and looking like an amateur. But you kind of just have to do it.
Yeah. How did you overcome those feelings?
I mean, I still like am overcoming those feelings to some degree. But what helps me is like just going online and looking up things first, and like kind of being familiar with language,
Knowing what you're going to ask. The right way to ask it.
Exactly. So that when you are asking the questions, you don't sound like you're totally like out of it.
And what about surrounding yourself with people to ask questions? Mm-hmm. How did you go about that?
Well, that was easy just through art school. Like I was in a fine arts program. So there's tons of people, like you're working with people that are in all different types of fields and interests.
So you had this community already around you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what were your first steps from idea to execution? What happened?
So when I started by looking for models, which is easy because I already had people in mind that I wanted to work with on different shoots and things. So I just reached out to them and asked them if they'd be interested in being represented by this agency. And I really played up the fact that we're like representing models of color, that we're dealing with diversity, that we're starting a conversation about representation, because at that time, like, we don't have a roster, we don't have a network, so I'm not going to be able to give these people jobs, you know? It's just basically asking people for a favor, essentially.
And what response did you get?
People were pretty on board. I mean, like, you know, with the first batch of models that we started to work with, a lot of them were my friends or friends of friends, and they were interested in modeling sort of, but not that seriously. So to them, it was like appealing.
So how do you start your own modeling agency? Step one, find models, have something to approach them with. Mm-hmm. If you don't already have existing clients,
exactly.
You get your model roster.
Absolutely.
Step two, how do you get clients?
Come up with something that differentiates you from what's already happening. And for us, it was that we're representing models of color and that we are dealing with representation hands-on. So it was really easy for us to get a lot of press. So that's how we started to get clients. We just got a shit ton of press. Just reach out to anyone and everyone you know in the industry. And like, funny enough, we didn't even need to do that. We already had like a following on Tumblr, because Tumblr, there's like a huge community of young people on Tumblr that talk about representation all the time and are already very skeptical of the industry. So when we came out, people were just like, whoa, this is exactly what we want to see. Right. And this is what we need right now. So we were basically, what I'm trying to say is that we were able to to gain clients through just having like a following and showing that look, there's an interest in this and people want to work with us.
There's a need.
Exactly. There's a need and we're filling a gap in the industry.
All right. Is Lord your full-time job?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you first started Lord, was it able to be your full-time job right away? Or did that take time?
It took time. Yeah. Like a good year.
And what did that transition look like?
Well, it was just like really sparse contracts here and there and like projects here and there. And at the time I was really only focused on us as an agency, as like trying to book jobs for models. Since then we've kind of developed into doing a lot of different other things as well.
What are the other things that you also do?
So we also do digital content production, which is basically brands will commission us to create content for their social media. And the appeal for brands to kind of approach us with that is that we'll help them diversify their image. So we'll reach out to brands that like historically have like a pretty white, normative, hegemonic image, and we'll help them kind of shake that a little bit.
Now that Lord is your full-time job, what does a typical day look like for you? What are you up to?
Emails and just like on my computer. So I'll probably be like on the scene shooting something or working in a studio maybe once or twice a week. And then I'll spend the rest of the week dealing with those images. So just like emails mostly.
Where do you work from?
Home.
Are you able to separate home life from mm-hmm. work life?
No, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I had a friend of mine give me advice like a few years ago, who's basically like, if you really want something and if you want like your career or business or whatever to take off in a particular direction, like you need to live it. It needs to be you. So that's the point that I'm at. This is like, I wake up and that's all I think about. I go to bed. That's all I think about.
As your agency grew, what did you learn along the way?
One thing that I'm like still learning and still trying to challenge myself with is like, you have to just keep persevering. You have to just keep reaching out to people, keep coming up with projects. Yeah, you need to just constantly like be on the ball.
On the ball.
Mm-hmm.
What are the next steps for Lord? What would you like to do next?
I mean, I would love to create a close partnership with some brands that kind of reflect our ideology or our ethos. I mean, I've kind of had difficulty figuring out who exactly, but I'd love to do something like that.
Do you think working in that way, partnering with brands, will maybe eventually lead to greater diversity in the industry as a whole?
I mean, I'm working within this monolithic industry, but I have developed a space, you know, like what I'm doing is like an avenue for people of color to show that like we're here and we're creating work. And I think like with us existing, it's like a statement for other fashion houses to kind of step their game up.
A lot of young people want to work in creative fields. The world of fashion is often seen as glamorous. Do you have any advice for young people just starting out who want to break into that world but don't know how?
I don't have any advice for just people in general. But if I had to kind of direct my advice, it would be for other women of color and other folks of marginalized backgrounds coming up in creative industries. For me, kind of the hardest thing in being a part of fashion is that there is nobody like me working in fashion. I don't see people that look like me working in fashion. I don't see people that look like my friends working in fashion. So it's impossible for us to believe that we even belong in these spaces. And I just want to encourage other folks of color, women of color especially, like just take up space and know that you are allowed to be wherever you want to be. And that's kind of the only way to really start, is to just put yourself out there.
Put yourself out there and sometimes be the only one.
I mean, I often have to remind people, it's like, just because I am running a business that is aiming to diversify the industry doesn't mean I'm actually doing that yet. Mm. You know, that's just kind of the end goal, or rather like just the very fact that I exist is making a statement about the state that we're in. So I'm working on that.
Do you feel like sometimes it falls on you to be the person who vocalizes problems around diversity?
I think definitely. I'm not at a place in my career where I feel like I have that much clout, but with certain jobs, I will. Like, I already have a coffee date set up with a client that I worked with on a job recently. That was like a mess as far as like creating safe spaces for people of color. Like, it was messy. So I think there are times where you definitely can, but I've had people in the past that took it terribly and like banned me from their business. So
when you are banned from someone's business, how do you react?
Well, with this instance in particular, like, I called out this hair salon based out of Toronto for appropriating black hairstyles on white people. And then on top of that, them not having black hairstylists even work for their salon. And I called them out on that, and they reacted pretty strongly and banned me from their business. And my reaction to that was like, I'm really sorry to hear that, and like, wish you the best. Like, have a good life, basically. You just have to let it go.
Let it go. Move forward.
Move forward.
Keep doing your work.
Yeah. Yeah. Better. Better, not bitter.
Better, not bitter. That's a good motto.
Yeah.
Kenna Rooks Eastman is the owner and director of Sandbox Studios, a recording studio located in Toronto's Regent Park. Despite dropping out of school at the age of 14, Kenna has a long track record of entrepreneurship, including artist management and independent consulting. A self-proclaimed activator, Kenna has dedicated herself to community service, working with organizations like East Metro Youth Services and NIA Center for the Arts. She's now opening a second location of Sandbox in Scarborough. Hey, Kenna, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
When people ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
Now, I kind of coined this term, so if you hear anybody else using it, it was me.
Rooks. Rooks, right, what is it?
Activator.
Okay, so what's an activator?
So whatever I do is going to activate purpose or, create a chain of actions after that.
So you are the owner and director of your own recording studio. How did that venture come about?
I was on a very long journey in music. I'd actually been managing an artist who was doing very well at the time, and we needed somewhere to record, and we couldn't really find a space that really catered to like an R&B or neo soul vibe. And at the same time, I'd actually owned another business called Chips, and we did laser cutting. And I'd received a grant from the city of Toronto to invest in an art entrepreneur. And so I had gotten $10,000. So I'm like, you know what? This is what we're going to do. We're going to spend the $10,000 I got from the city. We're going to build this studio for now. And then we'll collapse it when we're done making the album, because we'll all be rich and famous, right? Yeah. And I'll give the $10,000 back.
Yeah, but Sandbox didn't close after just that one record. When was that? How long ago
that
did you get started?
That was in 2012. So 2012 was a really strong year for me as a music manager. I'd kind of gone from, I was actually working at NIA Center for the Arts. I was the manager of human development and branding, working with Dr. Campbell, who actually also works with Ryerson. So yeah, he had mentored me a lot and taught me a lot just about, taking my expertise and trusting in that a lot more. And so I was working at NIA, and, the music thing for the artist just kind of took off, and there was so much room at NIA for me to like really invest that time in her, because we were an arts organization. I guess I was also like a guinea pig as well. So like, all right, you can go out and do this stuff and learn and bring back some of the contacts. So yeah, it was a really strong year for me in the arts sector.
Yeah, so it sounds like you had a lot of different kind of things going on.
Yeah.
Artist management, laser.
Yeah, I have a cutting, short attention span.
NIA Center for the Arts. The one that struck me most, though, was laser cutting.
Yeah.
Did you find a natural progression from laser cutting to recording studio?
The entrepreneurship piece. I think it took me a long time. I'm 27 now, and I think it took me a long time to really understand what it is I enjoy about being a serial entrepreneur. And it's the ideation into the creation piece of building a business. So thinking about how things will connect with other people and shooting the gaps in a market.
So all of your kind of different threads kind of tied together through starting your own initiative, just kind of seeing a need and trying to fill that need and kind of breaking out, which is the theme we're talking about today.
Amazing.
But that, I imagine, takes a certain amount of guts, a certain amount of like feeling brave just to say, I'm going to start this business. I have a great idea and I'm going to run with it.
Yeah, it's a certain level of grit. I dropped out of school in grade 9 and I'd actually not been at home. I was actually homeless. Mm-hmm. I'd actually like run away from home. I was really battling how to interact with my sexuality, with my family that was very religious. So it was half running away, half like the threat of like, get out of the house, and you know, all those emotions mixed together. So I actually lived on my own since I was 14. I learned really quickly that like I had to learn things. So I had to be very adaptive in spaces and very analytical. So, mm-hmm. you know, a part of it too is I'm 14. I'm a young girl. I'm not living anywhere. I also don't want anybody to know. And so like there was all these pieces that were always playing in my day to day, like how to just kind of work through the system without being noticed, but me noticing everything. And I think mm-hmm. that in that I learned a lot. And I also grew up with a mother who was an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. My mother had owned many businesses since I was a young child. So I grew up, you know, just being that 7-year-old, spending my summers, you know, asking people if they wanted tea, do you want some coffee? Because I knew very early that input equaled output. Mm-hmm. And so if I got up and I went to work with my mom instead of sitting home and riding bikes all day, if I went to work with her and I got up and I swept and I dealt with the clients properly and I interacted with them well, that would mean I might have $4 at the end of the day, which meant that I might have $300 at the end of the summer, which means that I'd get a PlayStation. So nice. That was kind of like always my thinking around everything is how do I get what I want myself? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where I learned to see the gaps.
Always have a goal in sight.
Always have a goal in sight. Always. Yeah. And it's doable. Everything is doable.
Yeah. Well, that's a great message. Everything is doable. You mentioned grit, resilience, adaptability, mm-hmm. analysis, but also just watching others do it so mm-hmm. that you know it's possible yourself and just kind of learning by doing, having that courage to move 100%. Forward and figure it out.
Yeah. My mother has been my biggest influencer in my life. She's always been a very hardworking woman and entrepreneur. You know, like I spent my first couple of years of my life in, you know, government housing. And, you know, by the time I was 5, my mom had purchased a house by herself, single mother, 2 kids, moved us to Brampton in this huge house and like just paid for it and ran her own businesses and was just always so resilient. Even now, like, you know, sometimes I sleep in and I think to myself, man, I never saw my mom take a day off or get mm-hmm. sick or, you know, like have an excuse for anything. Like our lunches were always made. There's not a day I can think of myself going without something. Mm-hmm. And so she really was my first example of like, hey, no excuses. Like you can do it. And if you can't do it, it's you deciding you're not doing it.
Have you always had that kind of support from your family?
You know, my mom and I didn't have the best relationship in my teens. And, you know, it's just amazing and such a blessing that we never gave up on each other. And we're like the closest of friends now. And a big part of the reason that I'm as successful as I am. So, you know, for anybody who's out there, like, I know that disconnecting from family is like really difficult. And, mm-hmm. you know, just don't give up on yourself and don't give up on them.
Let's go back to Sandbox Studios. Mm-hmm. So Sandbox is located here in Toronto in Regent Park. How did you first find your space?
I had gone to so many studios and, you know, speaking of entrepreneurship and to touch on, you know, some other, you know, intersectionalities or, you know, different things that happen being a young Black female queer entrepreneur, you know, mm-hmm. like I had gone to a lot of spaces and spoken to them over the phone and was like, you know, I want to open up a recording studio and, you know, they're like, yep, come by. And then I would come by and they'd be like, no, honestly, we're not even renting out the space anymore. Mm-hmm. Or some people would just straight up say, I don't want rappers here. I don't want.
Right.
And so, you know, I was really discouraged for about a month. I gotten all these yeses over the phone and I went to about 10 spaces. And every time I'd show up with First and Last, they'd be like, no. People have their own ignorance around what, you know, how they probably think happens in a studio. It's really disheartening. And then one day I was like, going to give up. And, you know, I got on the phone with somebody and I was like, man, forget this. And they're like, yeah, forget it. And when they said that to me, I was like, no, I'm not going to forget. Like, it was just like that disbelief and like, oh yeah, just quit. Like, kind of was like, that's not who you are. And so I just put in recording studio, Toronto rent. And then mm-hmm. this place popped up and
so you talked about the stereotypes, the unfortunate stereotypes sometimes we have around Black youth and mm-hmm. around hip hop music. What is the reality in your studio? What does a typical work day actually look like on the ground?
Sandbox, first of all, functions very different from other urban studios. I think that, you know, a lot of young Black youth, they see the music videos and they're educated through that and assume that that's the process. So, you know, I'm going to go to the studio. I'm going to bring a lot of people who support me, but it doesn't work like that at Sandbox. You know, we're very serious about the professionalism. So we tell all of our clients, you know, unless somebody is working with you, you know, you show up to Sandbox like you're showing up to work or you're showing up to work out with a personal trainer. You wouldn't bring 10 friends to watch you train, right? Like some days I'll work nonstop. Yeah. I've kind of found my own rhythm. Before I used to like, always try to wake up because I read all the time. I'm like, avid reader. And so like, I read all these books about really successful people and they're like, I'm up at 4 a.m. I read the newspaper for 2 hours. I do yoga for 1 hour. And so like, that was my thing. I'm wake up at four, but you know, it's not realistic. You have to do what makes sense for you. And I work in entertainment and sometimes I'm out till four, you know? And so really what I do is I plan out my weeks and I go and I go and I go, and then I take really long breaks. So like, you know, I might work 3 days really, really hard and then I'll take that day off and just kind of do my own thing, walk around with my dog, you know, hang out with my girlfriend, whatever that looks like. My niece, I have a new little niece. I love her so much.
Amazing.
You know, whatever that looks like, and then get back into it. Yeah. And so for me, it's really like work, work, work. Ignore everybody's phone calls. Mm-hmm. Work, 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 work.
And have you had to find that rhythm over time? Like the importance of taking time for yourself and taking a break?
Saying no is so hard for me because I like to help people. And my girlfriend actually yells at me all of the time. She's like, say no. We've been together for almost 4 years. And over the last 4 years, like every time I get into it with someone or I fall out with somebody because I've disappointed them, she's like, you just say yes to everything. Mm-hmm. And it ruins things for you. And she's like, even though you had good intentions, and I always do, it backfires. And so I've noticed, like I sat down and with, you know, that information she gave me, and I really looked over the list of people I've fallen out with. And a lot of it has been disappointment because I didn't live up to my expectations. And that's just because I say yes. I'm like, when I'm in that space and like things are vibing, I'm like, yeah, let's do this. And, you know, I've learned that saying no, not only is it important for my self-care, but it's also important for protecting my reputation. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to say no to everything. So I stepped down actually from my radio show at Vibe 105.5. I stepped down from every single thing I was working on except for Sandbox Studios.
And now is running Sandbox Studio your full-time job? Are there other kind of side hustles you have at the same time?
Well, yeah, I actually work as a creative director for a design firm called Unsigned. And a lot of what I do now is just like creative direction. Mm-hmm. I also consult a lot as a creative director for other brands around. Sandbox is kind of like, it has its own system now. And so it's a very passive business for me in terms of like me having to be really engaged in it. Recently, I've become more engaged because I opened up a second location and I built it with these two hands right here. Right. And so, it's required a lot of my time recently. It was time to expand because we were so busy at Sandbox. Like literally, like I was turning away clients every single solitary day. Like this kind of makes no sense. And at the time, my mom actually owned a commercial property. And so in November, she was like, you know what? This is too much for me. I'm going to sell this. And I was like, Mom, please, can I try to do this thing here? And she was like, we'll see. So I was like, I'll build it. I'll do it all. So it was kind of a now or never.
So you physically built your studio yourself.
Yeah, for everybody listening to me, go look at me on @Rooks on Instagram. I'm pretty strong. Pretty
all
strong
right.
looking.
Go check out those photos.
Yeah. but yeah, I physically built it. Like that kind of attitude. Like when I remember being younger and my mom had these salon chairs and they would crack all the time because they were like leather and people would like, you know, sit on them. So many people in and out and they would crack. And, you know, my mom would go to the fabric store and sew these cases that would go on top of the chair so that like look exactly like the chair. And like, so I always grew up like knowing that like you just don't give up on things. You don't throw things away. There's always a way. So
now you have two studios on the go. How do you manage that?
Honestly, shout out to my team, my team. I think it took me a really long time to learn that I needed to be supported by people who, one, believe in me as a leader. I think that, you know, that took a long time. I tried to work with a lot of other leaders, you know, and I think that that's key. You find the right team, you find the right people who are going to support you, and there's nothing you can't accomplish.
Yeah. And how have you gone about finding the right team or surrounding yourself with positive people, with people who are going to collaborate with you in positive ways?
Oh, man. Having really honest conversation, you know, I think one of the hardest things to do for a lot of people who are really excited about ideas to lay out their terms up front. Like, this is what you do, this is what I do, because it makes that separation, if necessary, a lot easier. So I've kind of built that model into the way that I interact with people so that we can end amicably and know what you do and know what you don't do. And just like find people who do what you don't do, but always be working at bettering those skills. So just even if you learn the basis of it, just try, you know?
Yeah. Just try.
Just try. Don't try. Do.
Do it.
Do it.
Just do it.
There we go.
can learn a lot from young artists and cultural workers about the process of making a living from creative work. But the products they're creating are also exciting and innovative. Cultural correspondent Jesse Cumming reviews youth creativity in music, film, visual art, literature, and design. This episode, Jesse explores the work of Toronto-based rapper and producer Claremont II.
Quest for Milk and Honey, the title of Claremont II's third album, is an aspirational one. If the 19-year-old Toronto rapper and producer hasn't yet arrived in the biblical land of richness and abundance, he's well on his way. Only 2 years into his career, he's already staked a claim as one of the city's most distinctive and ambitious acts. This latest album is an impressive testament to these abilities. Quest for Milk and Honey is a sly and exciting record, proof of both Claremont's charismatic delivery as well as his production skills. The beats across the record are idiosyncratic to say the least, and all dynamic. Its first track opens with an off-kilter loop that would sound more at home on a mix of UK garage music than a rap record. The sonic textures on the record exist at odds with the trap styles that continue to dominate mainstream rap. On several of Claremont II's songs, dreamy beats float with a refreshing lightness. Other beats are strange and irregular. They feel as if they might fall apart at any second, yet always snap together with remarkable precision. In 2016, Drake released Weston Road Flows in honor of the Western Toronto thoroughfare and adjacent neighborhood. The West Side is also where Claremont grew up, and he explicitly stakes his claim to the terrain on Owning the City when he dubs himself the King of the West End. If Drake isn't named explicitly on the album, his presence is felt. Toronto has had a vibrant hip-hop scene stretching back decades, but in many ways the superstar's rise has brought new attention to the city's artists. Young rappers now need to negotiate influence and expectations. They need to decide whether to align themselves with the style of Drake and other OVO artists or strike out on their own. For Claremont, the answer is obvious. "Don't call my city the Six," he spits on Hallelujah. On the album's opening track, Moses, Lemon Hope, he also insists, "Don't compare me to another artist." The record is strange and compelling throughout, and its freshest moments are the most exploratory. Claremont includes a number of short sketches that flirt with jazz, trip-hop, and even bossa nova. These miniatures are clearly produced to be heard as part of an album. In an era of singles, there's refreshing value in such a grand statement and demanding attention from audiences. A lot of Quest for Milk and Honey exists on the spacier side of things, but the closing track, Hallelujah, is an exercise in thunderous crescendo. At first, a minimal patter of beat slowly builds, until gradually reaching a din of live drum and organs. It's messy, but exciting. Proof of the rapper's ambitions to produce something unique and nuanced, even if it's not always smooth or club-ready. "This is just the beginning," he says, as the record's 42 minutes of creative energy comes to a close. The song title Hallelujah suggests that gospel sits alongside a number of other themes across the record. The ambitions on display are grand, and Claremont takes his work seriously, but there is also a certain playfulness on many of the tracks. The young rapper is only 19 and seems eager to emphasize his youthfulness. Real-life references to high school sit alongside cheekier nods to Nintendo 64 and Crayola crayons. On more serious tracks, like Temporary, Claremont raps about the constant threat of gun violence and other oppressions imposed on black lives. Claremont is young and talented, which is a recurring topic throughout the album. At times, the rapper has a swagger reminiscent of a young Tyler, the Creator, with less snark. Claremont is an earnest nerd, or coolest loser, to borrow the title of one of his songs. He considers his success both close at hand and deserved. Unlike overstuffed rap mixtapes with a rotating cast of producers and features, almost every track on Quest for Milk and Honey arrives with the credit, written and performed by Claremont II, produced by Claremont II, and mixed and mastered by Claremont II. The record is an impressive statement, the result of a young talent placing himself and his work on the table, challenging the audience to deny it.
For more information about our guests, check the show notes for this episode or our website, everydaywearehustling.com. Everyday We're Hustling is produced by Jesse Cumming. Our program is recorded and edited by Max Cotter, with graphic and web design by Lucy Woke. and music by Adam Waito. I'm your host, Marita Campbell, assistant professor in the School of Creative Industries at Ryerson University. Everyday We're Hustling is funded by the Creative Innovation Grant at Ryerson University.